Look at the pores of this skin with a magnifying glass, and they're so fine you can't even see them. But the kid starts eating grass, that skin's a different story. The goat eats grass, and the skin is like sandpaper. The finest glove leather for a formal glove is Watsimo. Kid, that's my boy. But it's not only the kid, son, it's the tanning. You've got to know your tannery. It's like a good cook and a bad cook. You get a good piece of meat, and a bad cook can spoil it for you. How come someone makes a wonderful cake and the other doesn't? One is moist and nice, the other is dry. Same thing in leather. I worked in the tannery. It's the chemicals. It's the time. It's the temperature. That's where the difference comes in. That. And not buying second-rate skins to begin with. Cost as much to tan a bad skin as a good skin. Cost more to tan a bad one. You work harder at it. Beautiful, beautiful, he said. Wonderful stuff. Once again, lovingly kneading the kid's skin between his fingertips. You know how you get it like this, Sumo? How, Daddy? You work at it. There were 8, 10, 12 immigrant families scattered throughout Down Neck, to whom Lulavub distributed the skins along with his own patterns. People from Naples who had been glovers in the old country, and the best of whom wound up working at Newark Maid's first home when he could come up with the rent for the small loft on West Market Street on the top floor of the chair factory. The older tanning grandfather or the father did the cutting on the kitchen table with the French rule, the shears, and the spud knife he'd brought from Italy. The grandmother or mother did the sewing, and the daughters did the laying off, ironing the glove in the old-fashioned way with irons heated up in a box set atop the kitchen's pot-bellied stove. The women worked on antique Singers, 19th-century machines that Lulavov, who'd learned to reassemble them, had bought for a song and then repaired himself. At least once a week, he'd have to drive all the way Down Neck at night and spend an hour getting a machine running right again. Otherwise, both day and night, he was all over Jersey peddling the gloves the Italians had made for him, selling them at first out of the trunk of the car, right on a main downtown street, and, in time, directly to apparel shops and department stores that were Newark Maid's first solid accounts. It was in a tiny kitchen not half a mile from where the Swede was now standing that the boy had seen a pair of gloves cut by the oldest of the old Neapolitan artists. He believed that he could remember sitting in his father's lap while Lulavov sampled a glass of the family's homemade wine, and across from them a cutter said to be 100 years old, who was supposed to have made gloves for the Queen of Italy, smoothed the ends of a trank with half a dozen twists of his knife's dull blade. Watch him, Seymour. See how small the skin is? The most difficult thing in the world to cut a kid's skin efficiently, because it's so small. But watch what he does. You're watching a genius. You're watching an artist. The Italian cutter, son, is always more artistic in his outlook. And this is the master of them all. Sometimes hot meatballs would be frying in a pan, and he remembered how one of the Italian cutters, who always purred "Chebelezza," and called him "Picciarello," sweet little thing, when he stroked the Swede's blonde head, taught him how to dip the crisp Italian bread in a pot of tomato sauce. No matter how tiny the yard out back, there were tomato plants growing and a grapevine and a pear tree, and in every household there was always a grandfather. It was he who had made the wine, and to whom Lulavov uttered, in a Neapolitan dialect, and with what he took to be the appropriate gesture, his repertoire's one complete Italian sentence. Na mano lavanad. One hand washes the other, when he laid out on the oilcloth the dollar bills for the week's piecework. Then the boy and his father got up from the table with the finished lot and left for home, where Sylvia Lavov would examine each glove with a stretcher, meticulously examine each seam on each finger and each thumb on every glove. A pair of gloves, his father told the Swede, are supposed to match perfectly. The grain of the leather, the color, the shading, everything. The first thing she looks to see is if the gloves match. While his mother worked, she taught the boy about all the mistakes that can occur in the making of a glove, mistakes she had been taught to recognize as her husband's wife. A skip stitch can turn into an open seam, but you can't see it, she told the child, without putting the stretcher into the glove and tensioning the seam. There are stitch holes that aren't supposed to be there, but are there because the sewer stitched them wrong and then just tried to go on. There's something called butcher cuts, that occur if the animal was cut too deeply when it was flayed. Even after the leather is shaved, they're there. And though they don't necessarily break when you stress the glove with the stretcher, they could break if someone puts the glove on. In every batch they brought up from Down Neck, his father found at least one glove where the thumb didn't match the palm. This drove him wild. See that? See, the cutter is trying to make his quota out of his skin, and he can't get a thumb out of the same height as the trunk, so he cheats. He takes the next skin and cuts the thumb, and it doesn't match, and it's no goddamn good to me at all. See here? Look. See here? Twisted fingers. This is what Mario was showing you this morning. When you're cutting a fourchette or a thumb or anything, you got to pull it straight. If you don't pull it straight, you're going to have a problem. If you pull that fourchette crookedly on the bias, then when it's sewn together, the finger's going to corkscrew just like this. That's what your mother was looking for, because remember, and don't forget, a Lvov makes a glove that's perfect. Whenever his mother found something wrong, she gave the glove to the Swede, who stuck a pin where the defect was, through the stitch and never through leather. Holes in leather stay, his father warned him. It's not like fabric where the holes disappear. Always through the stitch. Always. After the boy and his mother had inspected the gloves in a lot, his mother used special thread to tack the gloves together. Thread that breaks easily, his father explained, so that when the buyer pulls them apart, the knots sewn on each side won't tear through the leather. After the gloves were tacked, the Swede's mother tissued them, laid a pair down on a sheet of tissue paper, folded the paper over, then over again so that each pair was protected together. A dozen pairs, counted out loud for her by the Swede, went into a box. It wasn't a fancy box back in the early days, just a plain brown box with a size scale on the end showing the sizes. The fancy black box with the gold trim and the name Newark made stamped in gold came along only when his father landed the breakthrough Bamberger's account and, afterward, the account with Macy's Little Accessories Shop. A distinctive, attractive box with a company name and a gold and black woven label in every glove made all the difference not only to the shop, but to the knowledgeable upscale customer. Every Saturday, when they drove down there to collect that week's finished gloves, they'd bring along the gloves the Swede had marked with a pin where his mother had discovered a defect. If a glove bristled with three pins or more, his father would have to warn the family who made it that if they wanted to work for Newark Made, sloppiness would not be tolerated. Lou Lvov doesn't sell a table-cut glove unless it's perfect table-cut glove, he told him. I'm not here to play games. I'm here like you are. I'm here to make money. Na mano la venad, and don't forget it. What's calfskin, Seymour? The skin from young calves. What kind of grain? It has a tight, even grain, very smooth. Glossy. What's it used for? Mostly for men's gloves. It's heavy. What is cape? The skin of the South African haired sheep. Cabretta? Not the wool-type sheep, but the hair-type sheep. From where? South America. Brazil. That's part of the answer. The animals live a little north and south of the equator. Anywhere around the world. Southern India, northern Brazil. A band across Africa. We got ours from Brazil. Right. That's true. You're right. I'm only telling you they come from other countries, too, so you'll know. What's the key operation in preparing the skin? Stretching. And never forget it. In this business, a 1/16 of an inch makes all the difference in the world. Stretching. Stretching is 100% right. How many parts in a pair of gloves? 10, 12 if there's a binding. Name them. 6 fourchettes, 2 thumbs, 2 tranks. The unit of measurement in the glove trade? Buttons. What's a one-button glove? A one-button glove is 1 inch long if you measure from the base of the thumb to the top. Approximately 1 inch long. What is silking? The 3 rows of stitching on the back of the glove. If you don't do the end pulling, all the silking is going to come right out. Excellent. I didn't even ask you about the end pulling. Excellent. What's the most difficult seam to make on a glove? Full pique. Why? Take your time, son. It's difficult. Tell me why. The prick seam. The gauge seam. Single draw points, spear points, buckskin, mocha, English doze, soaking, dehairing, pickling, sorting, taxing, the grain finish, the velvet finish, pasted linings, skeleton linings, seamless knitted wool, cut and sewed knitted wool. As they drove back and forth down Neck, it never stopped. Every Saturday morning, from the time he was 6 until he was 9, and Newark Maid became a company with its own loft. The Dog and Cat Hospital was located on the corner in a small, decrepit brick building next door to an empty lot, a tire dump, patchy with weeds nearly as tall as he was, the twisted wreckage of a wire mesh fence lying at the edge of the sidewalk where he waited for his daughter, who lived in Newark. And for how long and where and what kind of quarters in this city? No, he didn't lack imagination any longer. The imagining of the abhorrent was now effortless, even though it wasn't possible still to envisage how she had gotten herself from old Rimrock to here. There was no delusion that he could any longer clutch at to soften whatever surprise was next. This place where she worked certainly didn't make it look as if she continued to believe her calling was to change the course of American history. The building's rusted fire escape would just come down, just come loose from its moorings and crash onto the street if anybody stepped on it. A fire escape whose function was not to save lives in the event of a fire, but to uselessly hang there testifying to the immense loneliness inherent to living. For him, it was stripped of any other meaning. No meaning could make better use of that building. Yes, alone, we are deeply alone, and always in store for us a layer of loneliness even deeper. There's nothing we can do to dispose of that. No, loneliness shouldn't surprise us, as astonishing to experience as it may be. You can try turning yourself inside out, but all you are then is inside out and lonely instead of inside in and lonely. My stupid, stupid, merry dear, stupider even than your stupid father, not even blowing up buildings helps. It's lonely if there are buildings, and it's lonely if there are no buildings. There is no protest to be lodged against loneliness. Not all the bombing campaigns in history have made a dent in it. The most lethal of man-made explosives can't touch it. Stand in awe, not of communism, my idiot child, but of ordinary, everyday loneliness. On May Day, go out and march with your friends to its greater glory, the superpower of superpowers, the force that overwhelms all. Put your money on it. Bet on it. Worship it. Bow down in submission, not to Karl Marx, my stuttering, angry, idiot child, not to Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong. Bow down to the great god, loneliness. I'm lonesome, she used to say at home when she was a tiny girl. And he could never figure out where she picked up that word, lonesome. As sad a word as you could hear out of a two-year-old's mouth. But she had learned to say so much so soon, had talked so easily at first, so intelligently. Maybe that was what lay behind the stutter. All those words she uncannily knew before other kids could pronounce their own names. The emotional overload of a vocabulary that included even, I'm lonesome. He was the one she could talk to. Daddy, let's have a conversation. More often than not, the conversations were about Mother. She would tell him that Mother had too much say about her clothes, too much say about her hair. Mother wanted to dress her more adult-like than the other kids. Mary wanted long hair like Patty, and Mother wanted it cut. Mother would really be happy if I had to wear a uniform the way she did at St. Genevieve's. Mother's conservative, that's all. But you do like shopping with her. The best part of shopping with Mother is that you get a nice little lunch, which is fun. And sometimes it's fun picking out clothes, but still, Mother has too much say. At lunch in school, she never ate what Mother gave her. Bologna on white bread is disgusting. Liverwurst is disgusting. Tuna in the lunch bag gets all wet. The only thing I like is Virginia ham, but with the crusts off. I like hot soup. But when she took hot soup to school, she was always breaking the thermos. If not the first week, the second. Dawn got her special breakproof ones, but even those she could break. That was the extent of her destructiveness. After school, when she baked with her friend Patty, Mary would always have to crack the eggs because Patty said cracking eggs made her sick. Mary thought this was silly. And so one afternoon, she cracked the egg right in front of her and Patty threw up. And that was her destructiveness. Breaking a thermos and cracking an egg. And getting rid of whatever her mother gave her for lunch. Never complained about it, just wouldn't eat it. And when Dawn began suspecting what was up and asked her what she had for lunch, Mary might have thrown it out without checking. "You're sometimes a troublesome child," Dawn told him. I'm not that troublesome if you don't ask what I had for lunch." Exasperated, her mother said, "It isn't always easy being you, is it, Mary?" "I think it's easier being me, Mom, than maybe it is being near me." To her father, she confided, "I didn't think the fruit was that exciting, so I threw that out, too." "And the milk you threw out? The milk was a little bit warm, Dad. But there was always a dime at the bottom of the lunch bag for ice cream, and so that's what she would have. Didn't like mustard. That was another complaint in the years before she began to complain about capitalism." "What kid does?" she asked him. The answer was Patty. Patty would eat sandwiches with mustard and processed cheese. Mary, as she confided to her father in their conversations, didn't understand that at all. Melted cheese sandwiches were what Mary preferred to everything else. Melted Munster cheese and white bread. After school, she'd bring Patty home with her, and because Mary had thrown out her lunch, they made melted cheese sandwiches. Sometimes they just melted cheese on a piece of foil. She was sure that she could survive on melted cheese alone, she told her father, if she ever had to. That was probably the most irresponsible thing the child had ever done. After school with Patty, melting cheese on pieces of foil and gobbling it down until she blew up the general store. She couldn't even bring herself to say how much Patty got on her nerves for fear of hurting Patty's feelings. The problem is, when somebody comes over to your house, after a while you get sick of them. But always she acted with Dawn as though she wanted Patty to stay longer. "Mom, can Patty stay for dinner? Mom, can Patty stay overnight? Mom, can Patty wear my boots? Mom, can you drive me and Patty to the village?" In fifth grade, she gave her mother a Mother's Day gift. On a doily in school, they were asked to write something they would do for their mothers, and Mary wrote that she would prepare dinner every Friday night, a fairly generous offer for a 10-year-old, but one she made good on and kept up largely because that way she could be sure that one night a week they got baked ziti. Also, if you made dinner, you didn't have to clean up. With Dawn's help, she would sometimes make lasagna or stuffed shells, but the baked ziti she made by herself. Sometimes, on Friday, it would be macaroni and cheese, but mostly it was baked ziti. The important thing, she told her father, was to see that the cheese melted, though it was equally important to be sure that the top zitis got hard and crunchy. He was the one who cleaned up when she cooked the baked ziti, and there was always a lot to clean up, but he loved it. "Cooking is fun and cleaning up is not," she confided in him, but that was not his experience when Mary was cooking. When he heard from a Bloomingdale's buyer that a restaurant on West 49th Street had the best baked ziti in New York, he began to take the family to Vincent's once a month. They'd go to Radio City or to a Broadway musical and then to Vincent's. Mary loved Vincent's, and a young waiter named Billy loved her, as it turned out, because of a kid brother he had at home who also studied. He told Mary about the TV stars and the movie stars who showed up at Vincent's to eat. "See where your dad is sitting? See his chair, Signorina? Danny Thomas sat in that chair last night. You know what Danny Thomas says when people come up to his table and introduce themselves to him?"
I don't, said the Signorina.
"He says, 'Nice to see you.'" And on Monday at school, she repeated to Patty whatever Billy at Vincent's in New York had told her the day before. Had there ever been a happier child? A less destructive child? A little Signorina any more loved by her mother and father? No. A black woman in tight yellow slacks, a woman colossal as a dray horse through the hindquarters, tottered up to him on her high-heeled shoes, extending a tiny scrap of paper in one hand. Her face was badly scarred. He knew she had come to inform him that his daughter was dead. That was what was written on the paper. It was a note from Rita Cohen.
"Sir," she said, "can you tell me where the Salvation Army is?"
"Is there one?" he asked.
She did not look as though she thought there was, but she replied, "I believe so, yeah." She held up the piece of paper. "Sesso, do you know where it is, sir?"
Anything beginning with sir or ending with sir
usually means I want money. And so he reached into his pocket, passed her some bills, and she lurched away, disappeared down into the underpass on those ill-fitting shoes, and after that he sought no one. He waited for 40 more minutes, and would have waited another 40. Have waited there until it grew dark. Might well have remained long after that. A man in a $700 custom-made suit, with his back against a lamppost, like a vagrant in threadbare rags, a man who from all appearances had meetings to attend and business to transact and social obligations to fulfill, self-consciously loitering on a blighted street near the railroad station. Maybe a rich out-of-towner under the mistaken impression that he'd landed in the red light district, pretending to stare aimlessly into space while his head is full of secrets and his heart is, as it was, thumping away. On the chance that, hardly enough, Rita Cohn was telling the truth and always had been, he might well have stood vigil there all night long and through to the next morning, thinking to catch Mary coming to work. But mercifully, if that's the word, in only 40 minutes she appeared. A figure tall and female, but one he might never have taken for his daughter had he not been told to look for her there. Again, imagination had failed him. He felt as though he had no control over muscles that he'd mastered at the age of 2. He wouldn't have been surprised if everything, not excluding his blood, had come gushing from him onto the pavement. This was too much to battle with. This was too much to bring home to Don's new face. Not even electrically operated skylights over a modern kitchen, whose heart was a state-of-the-art cooking island, would enable her to find her way back from this. 1,800 nights at the mercy of a murderer's father's imagination still hadn't prepared him for her incognito. It had not required this to elude the FBI. How she got to this was too horrible for him to contemplate. But to run from his own child in fear? There was a soul to cherish. Life, he instructed himself, I cannot let her go. Our life. And by then Mary had seen him. And had it even been possible for him, he did not fall to pieces and run, because it was now too late to run. And to what would he have run anyway? To that Swede who did it all so effortlessly? To that Swede blessedly oblivious of himself and his thoughts? To the Swede Lvov who once upon a time... He might as well turn for help to that hefty black woman with the scarred face, expect to find himself by asking her, Madam, do you know where it is that I am? Have you any idea where I went? Mary had seen him. How could she miss him? How could she have missed him even on a street where there was life and not death, where there was a throng of the striving and the harried and the driven and the decisive and not this malignant void? There was her handsome, utterly recognizable 6'3" father, the handsomest father a girl could have. She raced across the street, this frightful creature, and like the carefree child he used to enjoy envisioning back when he himself was a carefree child. The girl, running from a swing outside the stone house, she threw herself upon his chest, her arms encircling his neck. From beneath the veil she wore across the lower half of her face, obscuring her mouth and chin, a sheer veil that was the ragged foot off an old nylon stocking, she said to the man she had come to detest, Daddy... Daddy, faultlessly, just like any other child, and looking like a person whose tragedy was that she'd never been anyone's child. They are crying intensely. The dependable father whose center is the source of all order, who could not overlook or sanction the smallest sign of chaos, for whom keeping chaos far at bay had been intuition's chosen path to certainty, the rigorous daily given of life. And the daughter, who is chaos itself. she had become a giant. Her father didn't know what that meant until, in her unhampered, chat-like speech, the unimpeded speech with which she would have spoken at home had she ever been able to master a stutter while living within her parents' safekeeping, she patiently told him. The Jains were a relatively small Indian religious sect. That he could accept as fact. But whether Mary's practices were typical or of her own devising, he couldn't be certain, even if she contended that every last thing she now did was an expression of religious belief. She wore the veil to do no harm to the microscopic organisms that dwell in the air we breathe. She did not bathe because she revered all life, including the vermin. She did not wash, she said, so as to do no harm to the water. She did not walk about after dark, even in her own room, for fear of crushing some living object beneath her feet. There are souls, she explained, imprisoned in every form of matter. The lower the form of life, the greater is the pain to the soul imprisoned there. The only way ever to become free of matter and to arrive at what she described as self-sufficient bliss for all eternity was to become what she reverentially called a perfected soul. One achieves this perfection only through the rigors of asceticism and self-denial and through the doctrine of ahimsa, or nonviolence. The five vows she'd taken were typewritten on index cards and taped to the wall above a narrow pallet of dirty foam rubber on the unswept floor. That was where she slept. And given that there was nothing but the pallet in one corner of the room and a rag pile, her clothing, in the other, that must be where she sat to eat whatever it was she survived on. Very, very little, from the look of her. From the look of her, she could have been not 50 minutes east of Old Rimrock, but in Delhi or Calcutta, near starvation, not as a devout purified by her ascetic practices, but as the despised of the lowest caste, miserably moving about on an untouchable's emaciated limbs. The room was tiny, claustrophobically smaller even than the cell in the juvenile's prison where, when he could not sleep, he would imagine visiting her after she was apprehended. They had reached her room by walking from the dog and cat hospital down toward the station, then turning west through an underpass that led to the MacArthur Highway, an underpass no more than 150 feet long, but of the kind that causes drivers to hit the lock button on the door. There were no lights overhead, and the walkways were strewn with broken pieces of furniture, with beer cans, bottles, lumps of things that were unidentifiable. There were license plates underfoot. The place hadn't been cleaned in 10 years. Maybe it had never been cleaned. Every step he took, bits of glass crunched beneath his shoes. There was a bar stool upright in the middle of the walkway. It had got there from where? Who had brought it? There was a twisted pair of men's pants, filthy. Who was the man? What had happened to him? The Swede would not have been surprised to see an arm or a leg. A garbage sack blocked their way. Dark plastic. Knotted shut. What was in it? It was large enough for a dead body. And there were bodies, too, that were living. People shifting around in the filth. Dangerous-looking people back in the dark. And above the blackened rafters, the thudding of a train. The noise of the trains rolling into the station heard from beneath their wheels. 500-600 trains a day rolling overhead. To get where Mary rented a room just off MacArthur Highway, you had to make it through an underpass not just as dangerous as any in Newark, but as dangerous as any underpass in the world. They were walking because she wouldn't drive with him. I only walk, Daddy. I do not go in motor vehicles. And so he had left his car out on Railroad Avenue for whoever came along to steal it, and walked beside her the 10 minutes it took to reach her room, a walk that would have brought him to tears within the first 10 steps had he not continued to recite to himself, "This is life, this is our life, I cannot let her go," had he not taken her hand in his, and as they traversed together that horrible underpass reminded himself, "This is her hand, Mary's hand, nothing matters but her hand," would have brought him to tears because when she was 6 and 7 years old, she'd loved to play Marines, either him yelling at her or her yelling at him, "Tension, stand at ease, rest."
She loved to march with him forward, march to the left flank, march to the rear, march, right oblique, march. Loved to do marine calisthenics with him. You people, hit the deck. She loved to call the ground the deck, to call their bathroom the head, to call her bed the rack, and Dawn's food the chow. But most of all, she loved to count Paris Island cadence for him as she started out across the pasture, mounted up on his shoulders to find Mama's cows. By your left, right, left, right, your left, right, your left. And without stuttering. When they played Marines, she did not stutter over a single word. The room was on the ground floor of a house that 100 years ago might have been a boarding house. Not a bad one either. A respectable boarding house, brownstone below the parlor floor, neat brickwork above, curved railings of cast iron leading up the brick steps to the double doorway. But the old boarding house was now a wreck, marooned on a narrow street where there were only 2 other houses left. Incredibly, 2 of the old Newark plane trees were left as well. The house was tucked between abandoned warehouses and overgrown lots studded with chunks of rusted iron junk, mechanical debris scattered amid the weeds. From over the door of the house, the pediment was gone, ripped out. The cornices had been ripped out, too, carefully stolen and taken away to be sold in some New York antique store. All over Newark, the oldest buildings were missing ornamental stone cornices, cornices from as high up as 4 stories plucked off in broad daylight with a cherry picker, with $100,000 piece of equipment. But the cop is asleep or paid off, and nobody stops whoever it is, from whatever agency that has a cherry picker, who is making a little cash on the side. The turkey frieze that ran around the old Essex produce market on Washington and Linden, the frieze with the terracotta turkeys and the huge cornucopias overflowing with fruit, stolen. Building caught fire and the frieze disappeared overnight. The big Negro churches, Bethany Baptist closed down, boarded up, looted, bulldozed. Wycliffe Presbyterian disastrously gutted by fire, cornices stolen. Aluminum drain pipes, even from occupied buildings, from standing buildings, stolen. Gutters, leaders, drain pipes, stolen. Everything was gone that anybody could get to, just reach up and take it. Copper tubing and boarded up factories, pull it out and sell it. Any place where the windows are gone and boarded up tells people immediately, come in and strip it. Whatever's left, strip it, steal it, sell it. Stripping stuff. That's the food chain. Drive by a place where a sign says, this house is for sale, and there's nothing there. There's nothing to sell. Everything stolen by gangs and cars, stolen by the men who roam a city with shopping carts, stolen by thieves working alone. The people are desperate and they take anything. They go junkin', the way a shark goes fishing. If there's one brick still on top of the other, cried his father, the idea gets into their heads that the mortar might be useful, so they'll push them apart and take that. Why not? The mortar. Seymour, this city isn't a city, it's a carcass. Get out. The street where Mary lived was paved with bricks. There couldn't be more than 12 of these brick streets intact in the entire city. The last of the cobblestone streets, a pretty old cobblestone street, had been stolen about 3 weeks after the riots. While the rubble still reeked of smoke where the devastation was the worst, a developer from the suburbs had arrived with a crew around 1 a.m., 3 trucks and some 20 men moving stealthily, and during the night, without a cop to bother them, they dug up the cobblestones from the narrow side street that cut diagonally back of Newark Maid and carted them all away. The street was gone when the Swede showed up for work the next morning. Now they're stealing streets? His father asked. Newark can't even hold on to its streets, Seymour. Get the hell out. His father's had become the voice of reason. Mary Street was just a couple of 100 feet long, squeezed into the triangle between McCarter, where, as always, the heavy truck traffic barreled by night and day, and the ruins of Mulberry Street. Mulberry, the Swede could recall as a Chinatown slum as long ago as the 1930s, back when the Newark Lvovs, Jerry, Seymour, Mama, Papa, used to file up the narrow stairwell to one of the family restaurants for a chow mein dinner on a Sunday afternoon and, later driving home to Keir Avenue, his father would tell the boys unbelievable stories about the Mulberry Street Tong Wars of old. Of old. Stories of old. There were no longer stories of old. There was,
Nothing. There was a mattress, discolored and waterlogged, like a cartoon strip trunk slumped against a pole. The pole still held up a sign telling you what corner you were on. That's all there was. Above and beyond the roofline of her house, he could see the skyline of commercial Newark half a mile away and those three familiar, comforting words, the most reassuring words in the English language, cascading down the elegantly ornate cliff that was once the focal point of a buzzing downtown. 10 stories high, the huge, white, stark letters heralding fiscal confidence and institutional permanence, civic progress and opportunity and pride, indestructible letters that you could read from the seat of your jetliner descending from the north toward the international airport. First, Fidelity Bank. That's what was left, that lie. First. Last. Last, Fidelity Bank. From down on the earth where his daughter now lived at the corner of Columbia and Green, where his daughter lived even worse than her greenhorn great-grandparents had, fresh from steerage in their Prince Street tenement, you could see a mammoth signboard designed for concealing the truth. A sign in which only a madman could believe. A sign in a fairy tale. 3 generations, all of them growing, the working, the saving, the success. 3 generations in raptures over America. 3 generations of becoming one with the people. And now, with the 4th, it had all come to nothing. The total vandalization of their world. Her room had no window. Only a narrow transom over the door that opened onto the unlit hallway. A 20-foot-long urinal whose decaying plaster walls he wanted to smash apart with his fist the moment he entered the house and smelled it. The hallway led out to the street through a door that had neither lock nor handle, nor glass in the double frame. Nowhere in her room could he see a faucet or a radiator. He could not imagine what the toilet was like or where it might be, and wondered if the hallway was it for her, as well as for the bums who wandered in off the highway or down from Mulberry Street. She would have lived better than this, far better, if she were one of Dawn's cattle, in the shed where the herd gathered in the worst weather, with the proximity of one another's carcasses to warm them, and the rugged coats they grew in winter. And Mary's mother, even in the sleet, even on an icy wintry day, up before 6, carrying hay bales to feed them. He thought of the cattle, not at all unhappy out there in the winter, and he thought of those two they called the derelicts. Dawn's retired giant Count, and the old mare, Sally. Each of them in human years comparable to 70 or 75, who found each other when they were both over the hill and then became inseparable. One would go and the other would follow, doing all the things together that would keep them well and happy. It was fascinating to watch their routine and the wonderful life they had. Remembering how when it was sunny, they would stretch out in the sun to warm their hides, he thought, if only she had become an animal. It was beyond understanding. Not only how Mary could be living in this hovel like a pariah, not only how Mary could be a fugitive wanted for murder, but how he and Dawn could have been the source of it all. How could their innocent foibles add up to this human being? Had none of this happened, had she stayed at home, finished high school, gone to college, there would have been problems, of course, big problems. She was precocious in her rebellion, and there would have been problems even without a war in Vietnam. She might have wallowed a long while in the pleasures of resistance and the challenge of discovering how unrestrained she could be. But she would have been at home. At home, you flip out a little, and that's it. You do not have the pleasure of the unadulterated pleasure. You don't get to the point where you flip out a little so many times that finally you decide it's such a great, great kick. Why not flip out a lot? At home, there's no opportunity to douse yourself in the squalor. At home, you can't live where the disorder is. At home, you can't live where nothing is reined in. At home, there is that tremendous discrepancy between the way she imagines the world to be and the way the world is for her. Well, no longer is there that dissonance to disturb her equilibrium. Here are her Rembrandtian fantasies, and the culmination is horrifying. Their disaster had been tragically shaped by time. They didn't have enough time with her. When she's your ward, when she's there, you can do it. If you have contact with your child steadily over time, then the stuff that is off, the mistakes in judgment that are made on both sides, is somehow, through that steady, patient contact, made better and better until at last, inch by inch, day by day, and inch by inch, there is remediation. There are the ordinary satisfactions of parental patience rewarded, of things working out. But this? Where was the remediation for this? Could he bring Dawn here to see her? Dawn, in her bright, tight, new face, and Mary sitting cross-legged on the pallet, in her tattered sweatshirt and ill-shapen trousers and black plastic shower clogs, meekly composed behind that nauseating veil? How broad her shoulder bones were, like his. But hanging off those bones, there was nothing. What he saw sitting before him was not a daughter, a woman, or a girl. What he saw, in a scarecrow's clothes, stick skinny as a scarecrow, was the scantiest farmyard emblem of life, a travestied mock-up of a human being. So meager a likeness to a Lvov, it could have fooled only a bird. How could he bring Dawn here? Driving Dawn down MacArthur Highway, turning off MacArthur and into this street, the warehouses, the rubble, the garbage, the debris. Dawn seeing this room, smelling this room, her hands touching the walls of this room, let alone the unwashed flesh, the brutally cropped, bedraggled hair. He kneeled down to read the index card's position just about where she once used to venerate over her old rimrock bed, magazine photos of Audrey Hepburn. I renounce all killing of living beings, whether subtle or gross, whether movable or immovable. I renounce all vices of lying speech arising from anger or greed or fear or mirth. I renounce all taking of anything not given, either in a village or a town or a wood, either of little or much, or small or great, or living or lifeless things. I renounce all sexual pleasures, either with gods or men or animals. I renounce all attachments, whether little or much, small or great, living or lifeless, neither shall I myself form such attachments, nor cause others to do so, nor consent to their doing so. As a businessman, the Swede was astute, and if need be, beneath the genial surface of the man's man, capitalizing on the genial surface, he could be as artfully calculating as the deal required. But he could not see how even the coldest calculation could help him here. Neither could all the fathering talent in the world collected and gathered up and mobilized in one man. He read through her five vows again, considered them as seriously as he could, all the while bewildering himself with the thought, for purity, in the name of purity. Why? Because she killed someone, or because she would have needed purity whether she never killed a fly? Did it have to do with him? That foolish kiss, that was 10 years behind them, and besides, it had been nothing, had come to nothing. Didn't appear to have meant anything much to her even at the time. Could something as meaningless, as commonplace, as ephemeral, as understandable, as forgivable, as innocent? No. How could he be asked again and again to take seriously things that were not serious? Yet that was the predicament that Mary had forced on him all the way back when she was blasting away at the dinner table about the immorality of their bourgeois life. How could anybody take that childish ranting seriously? He had done as well as any parent could have. He had listened and listened when it was all he could do not to get up from dinner and walk away until she spewed herself out. He had nodded and agreed to as much as he could even marginally agree to, and when he opposed her, say, about the moral efficacy of the profit motive, always it was with restraint, with all the patient reasonableness he could muster. And this was not easy for him, given that it was the profit motive to which a child requiring tens of thousands of dollars worth of orthodontia, psychiatry, and speech therapy, not to mention ballet lessons and writing lessons and tennis lessons, all of which growing up she at one time or another was convinced she could not survive without, might be thought to owe, if not a certain allegiance, than at least a minuscule portion of gratitude. Perhaps the mistake was to have tried so hard to take seriously what was no way serious. Perhaps what he should have done, instead of listening so intently, so respectfully, to her ignorant raving, was to reach over the table and whack her across the mouth. But what would that have taught her about the profit motive? What would it have taught her about him? Yet if he had, then the veiled mouth could be taken seriously. He could now berate himself. Yes, I did it to her. I did it with my outbursts, my temper. But it seemed as though he had done whatever had been done to her because he could not abide a temper, had not wanted one or dared to have one. He had done it by kissing her, but that couldn't be. None of this could possibly be. Yet it was. Here we are, here she is, imprisoned in this rat hole with these vows. She was better off steeped in contempt. If he had to choose between angry, fat Mary, stuttering with communist outrage, and this Mary, veiled, placid, dirty, infinitely compassionate, this raggedly attired scarecrow Mary. But why have to choose either? Why must she always be enslaving herself to the handiest, empty-headed idea? From the moment she had become old enough to think for herself, she had been tyrannized instead by the thinking of crackpots. What had he done to produce a daughter who, after excelling for years at school, refused to think for herself? A daughter who had to be either violently against everything in sight or pathetically for everything, right down to the microorganisms in the air we breathe. Why did a girl as smart as she was strive to let other people do her thinking for her? Why was it beyond her to strive, as he had every day of his life, to be all that one is, to be true to that? But the one who doesn't think for himself is you, she told him when he suggested that she might be parroting the clichés of others. You're the living example of the person who never thinks for himself. Am I really? He said, laughing. Yes, you're the most conformist man I ever met. All you do is what's expected of you. That's terrible, too. It's not thinking, Dad. It isn't. It's being a stupid automaton, a robot. Well, he replied, believing that it was all a phase, a bad-tempered phase she would outgrow. I guess you're just stuck with a conformist father. Better luck next time. And pretended that he had not been terrified by the sight of her distended, pulsating, frothing lips hammering robot into his face with the ferocity of a lunatic riveter. A phase, he thought, and felt comforted, and never once considered that thinking a phase might be a not bad example of not thinking for yourself. Fantasy and magic, always pretending to be somebody else. What began benignly enough when she was playing at Audrey Hepburn had evolved in only a decade into this outlandish myth of selflessness. First the selfless nonsense of the people. Now the selfless nonsense of the perfected soul. What next? Grandma Dwyer's cross? Back to the selfless nonsense of the eternal candle and the sacred heart? Always a grandiose unreality. The remotest abstraction around, never self-seeking, not in a million years, the lying, inhuman horror of all this selflessness. Yes, he had liked his daughter better when she was as self-seeking as everyone else, rather than blessed with flawless speech and monstrous altruism. How long have you been here? He asked her. Where? This room, this street, in Newark. How long have you been in Newark? I came 6 months ago. You've been... Because there was everything to say, to ask, to demand to know, he could say no more. 6 months. In Newark, 6 months. There was no here and now for the Swede. There were just two inflammatory words, matter-of-factly spoken. 6 months. He stood over her, facing her, his power pinned to the wall, rocking almost imperceptibly back on the heels of his shoes, as though in this way he might manage to take leave of her through the wall. Then rocking forward onto his toes as though at any moment to grab her, to whisk her up into his arms and out. He couldn't return home to sleep in perfect safety in the old Rimrock house, knowing that she was in those rags, in that veil, on that mat, looking like the loneliest person on earth, sleeping only inches from a hallway that sooner or later had to catch up with her. This girl was mad by the time she was 15, and kindly and stupidly, he had tolerated that madness, crediting her with nothing worse than a point of view he didn't like, but that she would surely outgrow along with her rebellious adolescence. And now look what she looked like. The ugliest daughter ever born of two attractive parents. I renounce this, I renounce that, I renounce everything. That couldn't be it. Could it? All of it to renounce his looks and dawns? All of it because the mother was once Miss New Jersey? Is life this belittling? It can't be. I won't have it. How long have you been a giant? 1 year. How did you find out about all this? Studying religions. How much do you weigh, Meredith? More than enough, Daddy. Her eye sockets were huge. Half an inch above the veil, big, big, dark eye sockets, and inches above the eye sockets, the hair, which no longer streamed down her back, but seemed just to have happened onto her head. Still blonde like his, but long and thick no longer, because of a haircut that was itself an act of violence. Who'd done it? She or someone else? And with what? She could not, in keeping with her five vows, have renounced any attachment as savagely as she had renounced her once beautiful hair. But you don't look as if you eat anything. And despite his intention to state this to her unemotionally, he as good as moaned. Unbidden a voice emerged from the suite, wretchedly laced with all his dismay. What do you eat? I destroy plant life. I am insufficiently compassionate as yet to refuse to do that. You mean you eat vegetables? Is that what you mean? What's wrong with that? How could you refuse to do that? Why should you? It is an issue of personal sanctity. It is a matter of reverence for life. I am bound to harm no living being, neither man, nor animal, nor plant. But you would die if you did that. How can you be bound to that? You would eat nothing. You ask a profound question. You're a very intelligent man, Daddy. You ask, if you respect life in all forms, how can you live? The answer is, you cannot. The traditional way by which a giant holy man ends his life is by salachana, self-starvation. Ritual death by salachana is the price paid for perfection by the perfect giant. I cannot believe this is you. I have to tell you what I think. Of course you do. I cannot believe, clever as you are, that you know what you are saying or what you're doing here or why. I cannot believe that you are telling me that a point will come when you will decide that you will not even destroy plant life and that you won't eat anything and that you will just doom yourself to death. For whom, Mary? For what? It's all right. It's all right, Daddy. I can believe that you can't believe that you know what I'm saying or what I'm doing or why. She addressed him as though he were the child and she were the parent, with nothing but sympathetic understanding, with that loving tolerance that he once had so disastrously extended to her. And it galled him, the condescension of a lunatic. Yet he neither bolted for the door nor leaped to do what had to be done. He remained the reasonable father. The reasonable father of someone mad. Do something, anything. In the name of everything reasonable, stop being reasonable. This child needs a hospital. She could not be in any greater peril if she were adrift on a plank in the middle of the sea. She's gone over the edge of the ship. How that happened is not the question now. She must be rescued immediately. Tell me where you studied religions. In libraries. Nobody looks for you there. I was in libraries often, and so I read. I read a lot. You read a lot when you were a little girl. I did. I like to read. That's where you became a member of this religion, in a library? Yes. In church. Do you go to some sort of church? There is no church at the center. There is no God at the center. God is at the center of the Judeo-Christian tradition. and God may say, take life. And it is then not just permissible, but obligatory. That's all over the Old Testament. There are examples even in the New Testament. In Judaism and Christianity, the position taken is that life belongs to God. Life isn't sacred, God is sacred. But at the center for us is not a belief in the sovereignty of God, but a belief in the sanctity of life. The monotonous chant of the indoctrinated, ideologically armored from head to foot, the monotonous, spellbound chant of those whose turbulence can be caged only within the suffocating straitjacket of the most supercoherent of dreams. What was missing from her unstudied words was not the sanctity of life. Missing was the sound of life. How many of you are there, he asked, working fiercely to adjust to clarifications with which she was only further bewildering him? 3 million. 3 million people like her? Couldn't be. In rooms like this one, locked away in 3 million terrible rooms? Where are they, Mary? In India. I'm not asking you about India. I don't care about India. We do not live in India. In America, how many of you are there? I don't know. It's unimportant. I would think very few. I don't know. Mary, are you the only one? My spiritual exploration I undertook on my own. I do not understand, Mary. I do not understand. How did you get from Lyndon Johnson to this? How do you get from point A to point Z, where there is no point of contact at all? Mary, it doesn't hang together. There is a point of contact. I assure you there is. It all hangs together. You just don't see it. Do you? Yes. Tell it to me then. I want you to tell it to me so that I can understand what has happened to you. There is a logic, Daddy. You mustn't raise your voice. I will explain. It all links up. I've given it much thought. It goes like this. Ahimsa, the giant concept of nonviolence, appealed to Mahatma Gandhi. He was not a giant. He was Hindu. But when he was looking in India for a group that was genuinely Indian and not Western, and that could point to charitable works as impressive as those the Christian missionaries had produced, he landed on the giants. We're a small group. We are not Hindus, but our beliefs are akin to Hindus. We are a religion founded in the 6th century BC. Mahatma Gandhi took from us this notion of ahimsa, nonviolence. We are the core of truth that created Mahatma Gandhi. And Mahatma Gandhi, in his nonviolence, is the core of truth that created Martin Luther King. And Martin Luther King is the core of truth that created the civil rights movement. And at the end of his life, when he was moving beyond the civil rights movement to a larger vision, when he was opposing the war in Vietnam, without stuttering, speech that once would have impelled her to grimace and turn white and bang on the table would have made of her an embattled speaker attacked by the words and obstinately attacking them back, delivered now patiently, graciously, still in that monotonous chant, but edged with the gentlest tone of spiritual urgency. Everything she could not achieve with a speech therapist and a psychiatrist and a stuttering diary, she had beautifully realized by going mad, subjecting herself to isolation and squalor and terrible danger. She had attained control, mental and physical, over every sound she uttered, an intelligence no longer impeded by the blight of stuttering. And intelligence was what he was hearing. Mary's quick, sharp, studious brain, the logical mind she had since earliest childhood, and hearing it opened him up to pain such as he had never before imagined. The intelligence was intact, and yet she was mad. Her logic, a brand of logic bereft totally of the power to reason with which it had already entwined